KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. The Israeli-Hamas war, which may be finally drawing to a close, has dramatically reshaped the Middle East. As NPR's Greg Myrie reports, Israel's military has delivered powerful blows to several of its leading rivals in just over a year.
The ceasefire deal with Hamas in Gaza comes less than 2 months after Israel reached a similar agreement with Hezbollah in Lebanon. Both militant Islamist groups agreed to ceasefires after they were battered by the Israeli military and their leaderships were wiped out. Israeli airstrikes have also caused considerable damage to Iran, which backs Hamas and Hezbollah. While Israel has proved dominant militarily, it has inflicted massive civilian casualties in Gaza, greatly undermining the country's reputation. If the Gaza ceasefire takes hold, the latest round of Mideast fighting may be over, but the aftershocks are likely to play out for years. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The country's wealthiest tech titans will sit close to President-elect Donald Trump when he takes the oath of office on Monday. NPR's Luke Garrett reports they include Tesla CEO Elon Musk, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, and OpenAI CEO Sam Altman.
A source familiar with the planning tells NPR the tech billionaires will sit on the inaugural platform on the west front of the U.S. Capitol. Musk, Bezos, and Zuckerberg are the world's three wealthiest people, with a combined net worth of nearly $940 billion, according to Forbes. Musk spent $250 million to help Trump's campaign. Following Trump's victory, Silicon Valley CEOs have met with the president-elect and contributed to his inauguration fund. During his farewell address, President Joe Biden said, quote, "An oligarchy is taking shape in America." Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
The commercial company SpaceX says a test of its new Starship rocket has ended in a partial failure. NPR's Jeff Brunfield has more on the mission.
Starship is the largest rocket ever built, and it's central to billionaire Elon Musk's dreams of getting to Mars. It lifted off without a hitch.
We have liftoff.
It flew towards space. Moments later, its giant booster rocket flew back to the launch pad and was caught successfully by two giant mechanical arms, which the company has dubbed Mechzilla.
You heard it here. Mechzilla has caught the booster.
But shortly after the booster catch, Starship appeared to have engine trouble on the final leg of its trip to space. SpaceX then lost contact. The company says it will launch an investigation into what went wrong. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
The three major stock indexes closed down Thursday. The Dow, the Nasdaq, and the S&P were fractionally lower. Some analysts say they expect the market to trade in a narrow range in the near future until there is more clarity concerning the new Trump administration, which takes office on Monday. From Washington, this is NPR. Britain's Keir Starmer visited Ukraine on Thursday. This is the first trip there as prime minister. He signed what's being called a 100-year treaty with Kyiv. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports.
This treaty between the UK and Ukraine formalizes some of the British economic and military support Kyiv is already getting. It outlines cultural exchanges and scientific cooperation as well. Visiting burn victims at a Kyiv hospital, Starmer said the timing of his trip is no coincidence. With President-elect Donald Trump taking office Monday and vowing to end the Russia-Ukraine war immediately.
It's very important that we ensure that Ukraine is in the strongest possible
position.
Starmer and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky surveyed an honor guard, laid flowers at a Kyiv monastery, and held talks as explosions and air raid sirens wailed across the city. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani has reached an undisclosed tentative settlement with two former Georgia election workers who Giuliani was ordered to pay nearly $150 million in a defamation suit that they filed against him. The deal was disclosed in court filings Thursday after Giuliani failed to show up in a federal court. This is a judge was set to rule whether Giuliani would be forced to give up his Florida home and other personal items, including several New York Yankees World Series rings, to Ruby Freeman and her daughter Wandra Moss. In 2023, Judy was found liable of defaming the women, claiming they committed election fraud. I'm Dan Ronan, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. For nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at Mott.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
To follow the race closely to remember when it was finished and a historic announcement was made in June 2000. It was one of the most significant achievements in modern biology.
We are here to celebrate the completion of the first survey of the entire human genome. Without a doubt, this is the most important, most wondrous map ever produced by humankind.
Now, many scientists were involved in decoding the human genome, but one stood out. Before becoming a biochemist and a genomicist, Craig Venter was a surfer and a sailor, and then he made waves as a maverick. He pioneered a highly efficient technique for identifying and tagging genes. And while the government-led Human Genome Project was well underway, announced that his private company was going to take on the task of sequencing the human genome, too. Throwing his pipette into the ring turned a noteworthy effort to map the human genome into a riveting race between governmental and private efforts that galvanized public interest. By the time of its conclusion, the groups were collaborating and crossed the finish line together 3 years ahead of schedule. This was in great part due to Craig Venter's novel gene sequencing technique.
Now, in a few moments, we'll hear from Celera President Dr. Craig Venter, who shares in the glory of this day, and deservedly so, because of his truly visionary pursuit of innovative strategies to sequence the human genome as rapidly as possible.
And it revolutionized the field of genomics.
One of the wonderful discoveries that my colleagues and I have made while decoding the DNA over two dozen species, from viruses to bacteria to plants to insects and now human beings, is that we're all connected to the commonality of the genetic code and evolution. When life is reduced to its very essence, we find that we have many genes in common with every species on Earth, and that we are not so different from one another.
So you may wonder, as I have, what happened to Craig Venter after that monumental day? For a long time, he seemed to be everywhere taking part in our excited global conversation about what it meant to have identified the blueprint for humanity and the kind of new science it might unlock. Then his name didn't pop up in interviews as much. He seemed to recede from the public eye. Maybe after achieving a feat that was basically the moon landing of biology, he had retired from science. But Craig Venter hadn't retired. He had gone to sea. And he had taken his revolutionary gene sequencing technique with him. This is Big Picture Science from the SETI Institute. I'm Molly Bentley. In this episode, a conversation with genomicist Craig Venter about his multi-year voyage to catalog microbial life in the ocean and what he discovered about the roles that even the tiniest organisms play in its ecosystems. This episode is The Ocean's Genome. Venter wasn't the first scientist whose restless quest to understand the vast diversity of life on Earth prompted him to use his sea legs. In 1831, a young Charles Darwin sailed around the world on the HMS Beagle, where, for 5 years, he kept detailed notes on his observations of the natural world. Well, seafaring science expeditions continue, with some changes. The ships are a little bigger, but in keeping with his pioneering instincts, Dr. Venter made the subjects of study smaller when he set sail on his research vessel, the Sorcerer II.
There are reports that the ocean had very little diversity and microbes, and that just didn't make sense to me. And combining my love of sailing with science was, many people think, my best idea ever.
When the Global Ocean Sampling Expedition began in 2004, biologists had identified fewer than 2% of all bacteria on Earth. This is because if species couldn't be cultured in a lab, they were often too difficult to identify. But Craig Venter's team used that efficient sequencing technique to upturn the widely held belief that microbes were organisms of land, not water.
We found there was thousands of times greater diversity than anybody imagined, and that there's more microbes in the ocean than stars in the universe.
So what does it mean that the oceans are replete with microbes? I mean, it shouldn't come as a surprise. After all, we've discovered microbes in our bodies and on our skin. We've even found them deep in volcanic vents. But still, Dr. Venter and his colleagues discovered that the oceans are a veritable soup of microbes, a whole world that Darwin didn't even know existed. We'll hear what this means and how they sequenced their genomes and the surprising discoveries made along the way. But first, an account of the team's initial maritime adventure circumnavigating the world's oceans for over 2 years, where they sailed across 4 continents and to 23 countries and island groups. Our assistant producer, Shannon Geary, met with Craig Venter at the Festival of Genomics and Biodata in Boston to talk about his book, The Voyage of Sorcerer II, the expedition that unlocked the secrets of the ocean's microbiome.
So, Craig, can you give us an idea of what it was like to be on a boat that long? I mean, was it difficult sharing such a small space with a full team of people?
Well, actually, a 100-foot boat is large for a private sailing vessel. There's now much bigger ones. So everybody you'd be on for 8 hours, and you'd be off for 16. So even though you have 12 people on board, you don't see a third of them, you know, all the time. And so actually people get a lot of personal space, and you have the whole world outside. So it's pretty spectacular. And, you know, most sailors never go out of sight of land. A lot of sailors never leave the harbor. It was the most transforming experience of my life, other than serving in Vietnam. And it's the way to see the world, because world history was established by sailing vessels. You see the world from the point of view of the people who initially discovered these places.
Your expedition, first of all, you've convinced me. I've decided I'm coming next time. But your expedition started in Halifax and I believe ended officially, the last sample was taken in 2018 in Nantucket, Massachusetts, which, you know, not too far from where we are right now here in Boston. But it originally started with a pilot expedition to the Sargasso Sea, which at the time was considered a biological desert. But that's not what you found when you took a sample there.
They were up to the 7th organism discovered there, and we just took 200 liters of seawater. We have these different size filters, different pore size that collect viruses, collect small bacteria, larger single cell eukaryotes, all on different filters. We would ship them on dry ice back to the institute where they got broken open and sequenced. So, and when we did the very first study, instead of 7 organisms, we discovered 2,000. And we stopped sequencing after 1.5 million new genes were discovered. So we could have just kept sequencing those same samples and gone further, but it sort of proved the point that we could actually deal with complex mixtures of species and their DNA, and that diversity was orders of magnitude greater than anybody imagined.
Because the expedition was somewhat inspired by or followed Charles Darwin's expedition, can you remember back to when you arrived at the Galapagos Islands and kind of what that felt like as a scientist on a boat following a similar path to this, you know, great name ahead of you?
In fact, the Galapagos are one of the few places I've had a chance to revisit. I would. We used his logs and data, and everything looked very similar to what he described. It's being impacted a little bit by more people trying to move out of Ecuador into the Galapagos, but they're trying to limit that. Most of the islands are still pristine. The tortoises are all the, you know, just all the things as he saw them with the isolated genetics. Visiting this island, hiking around it, seeing all the bird life, you know, it was like going living history. You know, one of the greatest adventures was in an island not so far from there called the Cocos Island off of Costa Rica. It's where the opening scenes for Jurassic Park were filmed. And it looks very much like a Jurassic period with these giant birds that look like flying reptiles. And there's no inhabitants other than a ranger station there. There's a picture in the book of anybody that watched the movie Master and Commander knew the problem that all the ships that went to the Galapagos had, is there was no fresh water in the Galapagos. Sailing into this beach on Cocos Island, there were four waterfalls of fresh water going right into the sea. And so all the ships, including Darwin's, went there to fill their water barrels. And most of the ships took time while they were there to carve their names and dates into the rocks. So there's ones from the history of going back to the earliest date we saw was something from the 1700s. So all this history fell into place while we were there, but we had new tools to see the world that Darwin couldn't even imagine.
I think he would be pretty stunned to see the developments that have occurred since his time.
It would be phenomenal to get his view.
And that seems like a great segue into probably my favorite aspect of this book, which is just the adventure. I mean, truly, just the incredible stories that you have from, or must have, from this trip. And I'm sure there's even more than was included in the book. But one of the things that kind of kept coming up throughout the chapters was the various geopolitical snafus, maybe I'll say, that you ran into as you were going through all these different oceans and different countries and taking samples. So can you describe, I think one of the ones that stood out to me most was the issues you ran into in French Polynesia.
So there's a thing called the Law of the Sea. It's a treaty that most countries have agreed to. It started with a 3-mile distance off the coast of countries. And then as more and more fishing rights became concerned, that extended out to 100 miles. And so countries now, by this treaty, own all the genetic resources within their coastal waters. So we had to work through the State Department and each country's government where we wanted to sample in that 100-mile range. And because we were doing science and because I became very well known for sequencing the human genome, the geopolitics went up a notch or two. We could have quietly done it, just taking a sample of seawater. Nobody would have noticed until we eventually published the data. But you know, we complied with all the permits, but we got into issues beyond those. So in French Polynesia, there was a sort of internal battle between the French government in Paris and French Polynesia government in Tahiti as to who had the right to give permits and who really controlled the waters. So when we sailed into the Marquesas, we were placed under house arrest and threatened to be sunk if we left harbor. we took it seriously because the French sunk the Rainbow Warrior, the Greenpeace boat in New Zealand that was protesting their nuclear testing. And we got that problem solved by dealing with the French embassy in Washington, the U.S. State Department, and we had to get the U.S. Navy to intervene and inform the French Navy that we were a U.S. research vessel under U.S. protection, and they better back off. So we didn't get sunk.
Didn't you also get boarded by a SWAT team in Australia?
Yes. So in Brisbane, Australia, I'd just gotten back to the boat from the Institute in the States. I was on deck in the sunshine having a beer, and this rib with 12 heavily armed SWAT team members was coming up the river, and I thought, gee, that's unusual. And they pulled into the slip next to us, and I thought, this can't be a coincidence. And they came up with weapons drawn and said they were going to board us. And I told them that they couldn't, that we were a U.S. research vessel, and they didn't have a search warrant, and the embassy would have to be involved. And there was a female captain of the SWAT team. She said that there was a report that we had a methamphetamine lab on board, which was pretty absurd.
You were Walter White, but at sea.
Yes. So I made a deal with her. I said, if your team takes off their combat boots and ask a crew member to open any door or drawer or compartment, I will let you on board, because you'll see pretty quickly we do not have a meth lab on board. And it was clear immediately to her that we did not have a meth lab on board, and notified us that, you know, that we had somebody that was obviously not a fan of what we were doing. It turned out one of our crew members that was doing all the sampling was dating a local girl in Brisbane who used to be engaged to this TV personality, who was very upset that she broke off the engagement and was dating one of our crew members. So apparently he used his notoriety to call the police and report that we had a meth lab on board, trying to get some sort of revenge, I guess. So lots of things that have nothing to do with science. When you're traveling around the world, you run into all kinds of unexpected adventures. Those are just a few. We could not detail them all, but you know, it is a sailing adventure story. It's a science adventure story, and one where we made more discoveries of new species than the entire history of science combined up until now.
Next, we meet some of those new species when Seth Shostak talks to Dr. Venter and an expedition scientist as we deep dive into the ocean's genome on Big Picture Science.
The use of sailing vessels in science exploration has a long history, after all, because you can't really walk to the islands of the Pacific or the South Pole. Darwin's HMS Beagle in 1831 is probably the most famous of these expeditions, but 40 years later, the Challenger expedition laid the foundation of modern oceanography by doing a kind of recon of the world's seas. They mapped some of the ocean floor, measured water temperatures, collected samples of marine life, and, by the way, they found many thousands of species that were new to science. Well, following in these pioneering efforts, genomicist and biochemist Craig Venter circumnavigated the globe in his research vessel, the Sorcerer II, collecting samples and cataloging the microbes of the ocean. Dr. Venter drew inspiration from these earlier famous trips, and his goal was similar.
Understanding life on the planet.
Jeff Hoffman was the expedition scientist on Sorcerer II in charge of collecting the samples.
The goal was to see what was really out there, because no one really had any idea, because they hadn't taken this approach. And then, you know, after the first few samples get analyzed, even just kind of blew us all away, how much is actually in just a little bit of water.
Most of life on this planet is invisible without a microscope. Most are bacteria and other microorganisms, and they outweigh all the humans, animals, and plants that we can easily see. Yet, their great diversity is vastly unknown.
Now, of course, we knew that there were microbes in the soil and in the air. Anybody with a microscope will do an experiment to prove that to themselves. But as Dr. Venter said, scientists didn't think they were so diverse in the ocean, which, you know, at first glance looks like a pretty uniform environment from pole to pole. And certainly Darwin, for all his observational skill, wouldn't have known about these tiny organisms anyway, no more than he would know that one day the molecule DNA would become the essential and fundamental part of the theory of evolution.
Well, Darwin knew nothing about the genome. Obviously, he had ideas about genetics, but nobody knew what the basis of genetics remotely was. And everything that we look at is beyond visual acuity. So it's a world that Darwin didn't even know existed.
Could you briefly just walk us through when you were taking a sample and you were kind of dredging these filters in different points in different oceans? What did that look like? Like, about how far down were you putting the filters? Where were the microbes coming from in terms of, like, where were they in the water column?
So all these photosynthetic organisms aren't right on the surface because, you know, they'd probably get fried with too much sun. And so they're at different depths. And so we would measure where the chlorophyll max was, and we would lower our sampling pumps down to that level and pump the water. It was all less than 100 feet for most of the samples. Most of them were fairly close to the surface. Froze the samples immediately, and then we got to port, shipped them back under dry ice or liquid nitrogen to the lab, where they were broken open, the DNA isolated, and sequenced on the automatic sequencers.
And that's when you discovered just how unique these different microbial species were, even just 200 miles apart in the ocean.
Yes, until we saw the sequence data and analyzed it, we weren't sure what we had. So it's a totally different way of looking at the world. But every species on our planet is a DNA-driven machine, including us.
Basically, we'd stop every 200 miles or in different locations based on where we're at. We'd put a pump down in the water and collect between 200 and 400 liters of water. Based on open ocean, you need more water to filter through to make sure you get enough biomass to get enough DNA to sequence. So once it's collected, we sequenced it through three different size filters, a 3 micron, a 0.8 micron, and a 0.1 micron. After we'd gone through the filters, we'd also collect that filtrate and run it through a system that would concentrate viruses down, all the viruses in that amount of water, to about a liter.
Well, what did the filters look like when you pulled them out of the water? Were they, you know, just clogged with biomass or something else?
You know, open ocean samples, basically, as you go down lower, the bigger filters were bright yellow, then a little less yellow, and the 0.1 were like, you know, little tins of, you know, yellow-green from the stuff in the water. It based on where you were at, just decided how thick and what color the filters would look like.
Craig, you said that you took samples every 200 miles. Is that a magic number? Where'd you get that 200 miles?
So we copied the very first ocean expedition in the late 1800s, the Challenger expedition, and they stopped every 200 miles and sent a dredge to the bottom because the theory was there was no life below 18,000 feet. And 200 miles is roughly the distance a reasonable-sized sailboat can sail in 24 hours. So that's why Challenger did it over 200 miles, and that's roughly how far we would go as well.
Is there some reason to expect that the, if you will, the biome, the living organisms that are present in the ocean would change, you know, on distance scales of 200 miles, or is it just the practical matter of how fast the boats went?
Nobody had a clue, seeing that they expected very little diversity in the first place. So the question was, is the ocean a giant homogeneous soup, or is it millions of microenvironments? And with changes in sunlight, current, rain, turns out it's millions of microenvironments, and they're 80% unique every 200 miles. That means there's tremendous species variation, genetic variation over very short distances. It could be they change every mile in some cases, so nobody's ever measured before we did it.
I have to say, some of the first open ocean samples, because mostly the samples were on the coast, but we got probably through the Panama Canal, I would say, and taking a kind of a sample of there's nothing around. You just think there's going to be nothing on here. And yeah, there's plenty of them. All right, you're starting to realize there's stuff everywhere, even in the middle of nowhere.
So Jeff left Sorcerer to take several trips to Antarctica to sample down there, and that's where some of the highest biodensity was found in this frozen lake that he was probably the first to sample in.
I had no idea. It's an ocean-derived lake, but it's been a lake for, I don't know, 50,000 years, and there's no input, there's nothing. It's frozen 90% of the time, and then we drilled a hole, filtered the stuff, and we couldn't get 2 liters through the filter, which normally we can get 200 to 400. They were just so clogged with so much stuff.
Wow. That gives you an idea of the density of living stuff in the oceans. The team worked to identify and catalog what was gumming up their filters. Now, you can imagine the impossibility of isolating each bacterium or virus to decode its genome. Dr. Venter and his team used the tools he had developed to speed up the sequencing of the human genome more than 20 years ago. That was once a renegade approach, but shotgun sequencing is now standard.
Shotgun sequencing involves randomly breaking up the DNA into small pieces and then reassembling genomes by looking for regions where the small pieces overlap. But this is a confusing concept. So Shannon, we're going to turn to you now for an explanation of this. Your background is in biochemistry. Why would we break up the DNA if what we want to do is sequence the whole of the genome?
Yeah, so shotgun sequencing is a method that is less time-consuming and requires much less genetic material than traditional ways of sequencing. The computer program can recognize genetic sequences that we've already recognized in other organisms. So it speeds up the process because you have referential data that you're using as kind of a baseline.
Okay, so it's sort of like if you took many copies of a novel, of the same novel, and tore them all to pieces. You could assemble one usable copy by transcribing those smaller bits of paper, looking for where the sentences overlap, and from that, eventually assembling a whole book. I mean, that's kind of a rough analogy, but does that work?
I think that's a great analogy, especially if you're imagining a novel that's really long. Shotgun sequencing is most effective when you're trying to sequence huge pieces of DNA. That's the reason it was invented. Essentially, you're breaking up a long string of base pairs of DNA. You couldn't put a huge genome into a sequencer, for example, the human genome. You couldn't just stick that into a sequencer and say, go for it. It's much too long. It would take forever to try and string together. You're breaking it up into more manageable fragments that sequencers can more easily read, and then the computer algorithm stitches all those fragments together at the end, and it sort of is like putting sentences back in order to read a paragraph through.
Okay, thanks, Shannon. That helps a lot. Well, since scientists assembled the human genome after breaking it up into 25 million sequence fragments, Dr. Vinter trusted that the process could handle complex genomic mixtures.
We knew the mathematical tools we developed for sequencing the first genome in 1995, and then the human genome were so powerful that we thought it would be able to deal with applying it to the environment.
Jeff, maybe you can give an overview. You pull up these water samples every couple of hundred miles on this sailboat, and then you sequence them. Do you sequence them on the boat? Do you bring them back to a lab to sequence them?
No, we would ship them on dry ice from different ports that we'd come into. They would be extracted in the lab by, you know, people in the lab that had the right instruments and tools they needed. So we just collect it on the boat and put them in actual buffers to keep them nice and safe, and then froze them and then sent them back.
But if you freeze these organisms, I assume they're all dead after you've done that.
Well, you can actually freeze life and it's fine, but our goal was to isolate the DNA from all the organisms, so we didn't care whether they stayed alive on the filters or not.
So let me summarize. You take a sample here, you take a sample 200 miles from here, and 80% of them in the second location were different than any of those in the first location. I get that right?
That's correct, and almost all new to science. Nobody had seen them before.
So what are all those microbes doing? What is their role in ocean ecology? Well, they have many different roles, but one in particular is crucial.
50% of the oxygen that you have and we all have to breathe comes from the development of this huge diversity of photosynthetic organisms. They convert sunlight into oxygen, and that's how Earth got terraformed, you know, producing eventually enough oxygen to change our atmosphere. Earth did not used to have oxygen in the atmosphere. In fact, one of the major findings we've had is these weren't just discrete individual organisms, but clouds of around 10,000 or more related organisms all producing oxygen. The other key finding was, so for every bacterial cell in the ocean, there's 10 viruses or phage. The viruses control the density of all these organisms in the ocean, but the viruses don't want to kill their host because they need their host for replication. And one of the major findings was that the viruses actually upgrade the genetic code in their host cells, for example, adding new versions of photosynthetic enzymes to keep their host alive and healthy. So it's an environment that's changing second to second, and the entire basis of the food chain of everything we see and eat starts with these microbes. So it's one of the key messages: if we keep polluting the oceans and changing these organisms, we're at risk of extinguishing the very air that we need for survival.
Shannon, I wonder if you could put in perspective the way in which this technique is really a powerful tool to help us catalog and identify new organisms, such as these microbes.
I think Craig said it best earlier in the show when he said his goal for setting out on this expedition was to more deeply understand life on Earth. And there's no better way to do that than by studying the genomics of life on Earth, since genetics is our building blocks. It's the building blocks of how everything came to be. And the data he collected while on the Sorcerer 2 expedition, it has been used to build these really large genomic catalogs, like GenBank. And these large genetic databases have been a huge help to scientists worldwide and have led to some incredible research discoveries. I mean, the more genetic sequencing data that we have, the more we know about different genes, how they function, what different genes do in different organisms. And all of that will lead to the discovery of new species. It'll help us classify new species easier. It'll give us insights into how certain species, whether it be microorganisms like viruses, or whether it be like physical marine life, how those organisms have evolved on Earth. I mean, the possibilities with that sort of information are just endless.
And in that way, he was building upon what was learned by other seafaring voyages, the HMS Challenger and Darwin's, but also drawing on a similar philosophy that there is a lot to be learned from cataloging and observing the natural world.
That was certainly Charles Darwin's role aboard the Beagle. It was to be an observer.
Back in those days, survey ships, which he was on, always took a naturalist along. And so he was the naturalist on board this geographic survey ship. But both showed the power of observational science, which today is deemed, inferior, because the government wants you to have a hypothesis you're testing. The government didn't want to fund this. They call these things fishing expeditions. But if you like to eat fish, fishing expeditions aren't such horrible things. And we showed that observational science is not dead, and that people have learned any kid can go out and take a cup of seawater or pond water or lake water, isolate the organisms, sequence the DNA, and today make totally new discoveries on a constant basis. So we literally were scratching the surface of diversity in the oceans.
Next, how human behavior is affecting that diversity. It now includes microbes that feed on plastic.
But can we make use of their appetite? We continue our dive into the ocean's genome on Big Picture Science.
About the diversity of marine microbes, they're a fundamental part of our ecosystem, most notably because some produce the oxygen we breathe. But human activity is introducing new challenges, with the result that many microbial species have modified their DNA in response. Researcher Jeff Hoffman says in the last 100 years, an additional component of the ocean environment has prompted a new adaptive behavior in microbes, the ability to eat plastic.
We're definitely looking into these bacteria that colonize on floating plastic in the ocean. We did a test run in 2017 up the coast, collecting plastic and isolating stuff. I mean, I think it's very clear, if I could be wrong, that there's definitely some ideas that these bacteria are degrading the plastic and living off of it.
Well, as I said, they're changing second to second, minute to minute. And so when there's a new chemical substrate for them to grow on, because of all the UV light and oxygen, cells mutate very quickly, which enables them to adapt to new chemical sources.
Craig Venter writes in his account of the Sorcerer II expedition that one day, while sailing in the Pacific on open waters, expecting not to see anything for miles around except the beautiful blue sky, the team came across what looked like an endless stream of plastic, toys, plates, flip-flops, and sunglasses. Even a refrigerator floated by.
The amount of plastic is exceeding current rates of degradation. But that's the problem. It gets broken down into these microplastic particles that fish and every other species inhale and becomes part of shortening their lifespan.
Perhaps the hope for dealing with the abundance of plastic may come from the microbes themselves. Some scientists suggest that maybe these tiny organisms could be used to help us clean up our own mess. Dr. Venter agrees, but with a caveat.
So it's a partial solution. Part of the problem is some of these microbes degrade the plastic chemicals into very toxic compounds. So the solution can be worse than the primary problem, but microplastic is now invading virtually every species in the ocean. We did a sampling, I don't know if you've ever been to Lake Tahoe. It looks like beautiful blue pristine water just from dragging a plankton net for a few miles. We collected several million pieces of microplastic. It's everywhere. We've contaminated virtually every environment on this planet, and we have to find some solutions for it.
You know, it seems to me that, this is a very naive question, but there should be sort of one optimal design for a microbe living, you know, 5 meters down in the ocean. And obviously, you know, 5 meters down would have different temperatures depending what your, you know, latitude was, that sort of thing. But why do you need this incredible diversity? What does it get the microbes to be different from the next microbe over?
Well, your question is sort of the naivety that led to people thinking there was not much diversity. In different parts of the ocean, for example, the Pacific Ocean near Panama, there's totally different phosphate levels in the water than there are closer to Australia. The organisms change in how much phosphate they metabolize, what they do. If all life on Earth was just one monoculture and all species were the same, it would have probably gone out of existence a long time ago. The diversity of life is what keeps all life going. Microbes are constantly in competition with each other. The chemistry that we discovered in this diversity of organisms is far more complex chemistry than the best human chemists can reproduce. Life exists in every niche on this planet. You have more microbes inside of you and on your skin than people thought existed in normal diversity. So we live in a microbial world. We're carriers of these microbes. We're alive because of them.
You know, as a human who doesn't like to get sick, maybe you guys can tell me whether seeing all these microbe capabilities, as it were, all this variation in the kind of microbial life that you can find in the ocean might allow us to steal some of them, some of the chemistry that's going on there to use in treating diseases. Is there that kind of practical application in any of this?
People are constantly trying to isolate new antibiotics from these organisms, potentially new anti-cancer drugs, but the chemical pathways we think are going to lead to everything from new medicines to new chemicals for manufacturing. It's a chemical repertoire that's not part of the human environment currently, and biology produces far more complicated chemistry than can be produced in a research lab.
You know, Shannon, when Dr. Venter described the microbes on us or in us, it got me humming. We're living in a microbial world, and I am a microbial girl.
It's so funny. I was thinking of that song, too. So the expedition, the samples collected during the expedition, discovered many new species of bacteria and viruses. And, you know, oftentimes, I think bacteria and viruses have a somewhat negative connotation. They're things that make us sick. But they're actually necessary for life on this planet and for human life to exist. So could you talk a little bit about that?
So again, that's part of the human-centric view of life. A very, very small fraction of bacteria and viruses care about humans or cause any disease in humans. In fact, you have about 3 pounds of bacteria in your body, your microbiome, that's helping keeping you healthy and alive.
So you're saying I shouldn't go home and take a very hot shower and try to get all that off?
No, in fact, you know, so many products are trying to, you know, sterilize ourselves. You know, we can't, if you eliminate bacteria from your body, you will not live very long or very healthily. They're important for your digestion. You have microbes in our skin, different microbes around each tooth in your mouth. I mean, we have so many microenvironments that are essential for our health. Very few cause disease, but because a lot of things were discovered associated with human diseases, that's sort of how the field of microbiology built. It wasn't built on characterizing the 99.99% of microbes and viruses that live on this planet, which is a microbial planet that we're sort of visitors to. We focus as humans on the ones like SARS or others that, you know, cause disease. And, you know, that's not crazy. Some of them have killed a very large number of people in pandemics over history. But most microbes are working to keep us alive, not causing problems.
You know, Craig really pushes back on this idea that microbes are simple or incidental. Just because they're small doesn't mean they aren't complex and don't have a fundamental role to play on Earth.
Well, exactly. And this brings us to the big picture a little early in the show. But what I'm thinking now are the words that Craig said in his speech at the human genome announcement that we heard in the beginning of the episode. That is, we sequenced all these species from plants to animals and now microbes, and we have discovered that we are all connected through the genetic code and through evolution.
Yeah, we learned about this interconnectedness, but we don't really feel that kinship. We're not often living as though we're all interconnected. And what strikes me the most is that life on Earth could exist without humans, but it couldn't exist without these microbes. That's really hard to take in. I think it's easier for us to acknowledge the impact we're having on macro life, like polar bears or ice caps melting. But because microbes are integral to life everywhere, any negative impact we have on them is going to affect the rest of our biome too.
And that illusion of invisibility also applies to the effects that we are having on the oceans far offshore.
People think that there's no problem with throwing some trash in the streets and the oceans and the lakes, and they think, you know, it's just them with their little bit of trash. People that used to, they change the oil in their cars, they dump the waste oil in the water or someplace else, thinking the ocean's so vast, this is not going to affect anything. And then you get 6 billion people doing that, and we just have massive pollution. But individuals don't think their contribution is great. But the impact of each human keeps getting greater with sort of the disposable lifestyle that we're now living in versus reusing things. So it's something we all have to learn.
You know, it's interesting too. I mean, in some ways, it's easy to be pessimistic, thinking that individual actions don't have too big of an impact. But if individual actions can have a large negative impact on our, you know, global ecosystem, assumedly positive changes, small individual positive changes, can add up to a larger positive impact on our Earth too.
Everything we do as individuals count. And it's nice in places like San Diego, they recycle the trash. They're even now starting a new thing with things that could go into a composite pile, or are now even having to be separated at each individual home. So some places are getting very progressive and aggressive with this versus just dumping more and more into landfills and runoff and into oceans. But some places, I mean, New York City, not very long ago, used to take all the trash from New York City onto large barges, tow them out a few miles to sea, and dump it all in the ocean. I hope they're not still doing that. I don't know for sure. But even when we started the expedition up in Halifax, at that time, Halifax did not have sewage treatment plants, and all the sewage from the city of Halifax just went right into the harbor. And we found traces of that with the microbes as we were taking samples there. In some places, the water smelled like sewage. They've since added sewage treatment plants, but you know, much of the world still does not do that. I mean, those are simple steps we can take in a society to make a big difference.
For his final thoughts, Craig Venter reflected on what it means that large areas of the ocean are now hypoxic, where pollution has caused dissolved oxygen to fall to dangerous levels, what scientists call dead zones.
These dead zones are very important for our future. There's multiple rivers in England now where each year they pump oxygen into the rivers to try and keep fish alive for local fishermen and stuff. And we found a dead zone that's been characterized by oceanographers as about the size of Africa, where mammals, fish can't survive because there's no oxygen. The organisms we discovered so many of produce 50% of the oxygen. So I think the discoveries we made of these tens of billions of new organisms that help keep us alive and are the basis of the food chain are critical to human survival. And we have to start changing what we do.
And I think a lot of the topics that we cover on our show feed into this idea. You have a line towards the end of your book about how human beings tend to think in very human-centric ways. We're not always great about kind of relating to and empathizing with the total ecosystem around us, and probably particularly for microorganisms, organisms that we can't see with our own two eyes. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like, how do we break out of that human-centric view, and why is it so essential that we do for the future of our planet?
Well, we started out with religions, with, you know, Earth being the center of the universe, humans being the, you know, the center of all life. And, you know, we sort of live in a very narrow zone. We have microorganisms that live at very high pH or very acidic pH, so strong that if you put your finger in that water, it'll dissolve your skin. We have organisms that live as high as 130 degrees centigrade. We wouldn't do too well at that temperature. You know, we'd be cooking. Ones that can stand high radiation doses. I mean, the diversity of life on our planet is absolutely stunning, and we could not live in any of those environments. But there's not a single environment on this planet that doesn't have microbial life in it. And they adapt to the extremes of what's there. So we're a long way from being the center of the universe or the center of biology. We're at least a species that has the ability to understand our own biology and our own place in the universe. But we're falling pretty short of that in terms of guaranteeing our own survival on this planet if we don't start changing what we do.
Craig Venter is the founder of the J. Craig Venter Institute and co-author of The Voyage of Sorcerer II, the expedition that unlocked the secrets of the ocean's microbiome. Jeff Hoffman is the lab operations manager at the Venter Institute and was an expedition scientist on board the Sorcerer II.
This show would not be possible without the macro talents of senior producer Gary Niederhoff and assistant producers Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley.
Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit education and research organization that studies life in all its complexity. I'm the Institute's senior astronomer, Seth Shostak. A big thanks to our Patreon supporters and all our listeners.
The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science, about the surprising diversity of microbes discovered in our seas, is The Ocean's Genome.
This program was brought to you by Jim and Shirley Brown's Apartments, located in Sandpoint above Trident Seafoods and the Boat Harbor, featuring two-bedroom apartments on a month-to-month basis. For more information, call Jim Brown at 386-6050.